I'm Bailey Parnell, and this is Let's Think This Through. Join me for drinks as I bring on guests for conversations that inspire, amuse, and challenge us, but in a fun and relaxing kind of way. Ultimately, it's to help us all learn and live a better, easier life. So let's think this through. Hello, all you wonderful people. I am so glad that you are here and ready to think some things through with me on this fabulous Tuesday. It is the beginning of March, and March brings the start of spring here in the Northern Hemisphere. And when I think of spring, I think about change. Because, you know, for many of us, winter, it's often that time of reflection and rest. And if you're really lucky, maybe you're even getting a pause from life's relentless pace. But as winter's chill wanes and spring emerges with a burst of life, the trees are budding, the flowers are blooming, and you know I am here for a good growth metaphor. With spring comes that like fresh start in this big old circle of life. And it was actually around this time, about 6 years ago, I think, where I met my next guest. And we met in kind of a funny way. My husband and I actually rented an Airbnb for the weekend in Port Elgin, Ontario, off of Lake Huron. And the host of that Airbnb is my next guest. Yep, literally just like that. He went from being our Airbnb host to a friend all the way to a guest at our wedding. Because you just never know where you're going to meet people. But through that Airbnb process, he and my husband actually realized that they were in the same industry. They both write and speak professionally about all sorts of things regarding leadership and the future of work. And one of those things is change. In fact, he actually wrote the book on it, no joke. So we're going to talk about all things change. And I'm really excited for you to have a drink with the one and only Greg Brown on Let's Think This Through. Hello, Greg.
Hey, Bailey.
What are you drinking over there?
Well, I'm having a little Bailey with my coffee. But no Baileys in my coffee.
I was going to say, actually, because...
No, there's no Baileys in here. I have a work day, but I'm having a bit of Bailey right here on our nice little podcast with my coffee.
I love it. I am on coffee today, too, in my little United Nations mug I got at the headquarters here.
Oh, nice, nice, nice.
But it is funny, because when I did ask you, for everyone listening, you know, would you rather do a cocktail vibe or a morning vibe, you said, I'm better in the morning, but we should make it fun like cocktails.
Yeah.
So how are you introducing yourself to everyone these days?
You know... It changes every day, depending upon sort of what mood I'm in. Mm-hmm. You know, when I talk to people and introduce myself, so I really just say, you know, I talk to people a lot about being future ready and how to step in the future rapidly because, you know, the pace of change has picked up and is just going to continue to do so. So how do we get in there fast? And that's sort of where my expertise has been for the last number of years. So that's where I go with that.
Mm-hmm. And the way that you deliver that, of course, is through your books, which they don't know, but is right behind me on this bookshelf right over there.
Yeah,
you know what? Give us a little plug there.
Yeah, my little book, Spark Action, How to Lead Change That Matters. It's all about creating change on the planet.
Yeah. And it's funny because when we were connected for the first time, the listeners, they've already heard me say it was through an Airbnb experience that you met Hamza. But how did that even happen? Because like, did you like look him up or something?
No. What happened was we had, we used to rent out our lake house, which we don't anymore. So it looks completely different than when you used to stay there, by the way. Yeah, it's totally redone. But yeah, he reached out just to book it. And then... you guys went and I didn't know anything about his experience or anything. And then I think afterwards, we were chatting just like, how was your experience? And he was like, I saw that you did this. I'm like, I think I did that.
Oh, okay. So Hamza was the creep.
I think it was. I don't remember much other. I mean, when people used to book our place, I would do a little search on them to make sure they weren't, you know, not people I wanted to rent to. Such as axe murderers or something. And both of you didn't really fit that profile. So, because I used to work with those types of folks. So I sort of have that feeling with them. Yeah.
Right. So was that in the correctional facility?
Yeah. So I come from the world. I mean, I started my career at Starbucks many years ago and was part of the team that opened the first wave in Canada back in the late 80s, early 90s, if you can believe that.
Totally.
But then I, you know, wanted to do something a bit more meaningful, and I started to volunteer and then work with people living on the street who are injection drug users. And then that led to working with people in prison, with guys in jail. So, yeah, I worked at, you know, maximum medium security facilities out on the West Coast, federal penitentiaries. So, yeah.
Oh, my gosh, I have so many questions.
Oh, ask them. They're great people.
Let's think this through, right? Like, what is the thing? This is the one coming to mind. Like, what's the thing that people would be most surprised by with the people that you met in those prisons?
That the biggest thing I think people would be surprised by would be, there's two things. One, I never felt unsafe ever once with the guys when I was alone with them. And I'd be alone with 30 or 40 of them. Never felt unsafe once. Didn't matter. Yeah, never felt unsafe. Don't forget, I'm in a facility that's contained, but I would be alone with them. Never felt unsafe.
Yeah, I think that would surprise people.
Yeah, the second piece is that most of the guys I worked with, not all, but I'll say 98%, and I never worked with like serial killers or the really, you know, bad. I mean, I worked with, I think the thing that biggest surprise people is that they're good people who've done bad things. Mm-hmm. And I'm not condoning whatever they did, because it could range on anything, you know, through to murder. I'm not condoning any of that or sanctioning that. But what I am saying is there's a lot of good in these guys, that, and a lot of them will never get out of jail, and you don't want them to. But there are a lot of amazing guys I worked with who wanted to create good change while they were institutionalized. Because, and the premise being is, if they want to create something good within there, it's safer for me, it's safer for the other people that work in there. So, you know, there are great programs, and, you know, I have art all around my office, indigenous art that guys have carved for me over the years. And, you know, it was a great experience, life-changing for me, because, and it really created my belief in social change and social justice.
Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, I think right then and there, like, I don't think people, the thing I said people would be maybe surprised by is, like, you think an axe murderer or something like this, and you think a lot of people in society just write them off. But yeah. I've always viewed, you know, the punitive system not so much as that. I've always thought that, you know, reformation would work better. And I don't even know this, but I would already bet that the work that you did with them was probably more impactful than sitting in a cell.
Well, and this is the thing, this is the difference between the US prison system and Canadian prison system. You know, Canadian prison system is not private. Mm-hmm. So it's funded publicly. And, you know, a lot of it's about rehabilitation. And some people don't get that. Like, you know, the really bad people that make the press are all locked up at Kingston, you know, out in that area. I never worked with those types of folks that made the news generally. You know, I'm not even going to mention names because I don't believe in promoting any of that. But the ones I worked with, you know, a lot of them would get out of jail at some point. And, you know, when you want them, when they're getting out, you want them to be less violent, less, you want them to be more compassionate. You want them to have empathy. Because what happens is a lot of the, you know, most of the crimes I can speak here in Canada are committed under the influence of drugs and alcohol. And, you know, many, not all, but many come from families that are disenfranchised or living in poverty and are trying to get by, or were shot up by, you know, their parents shot them up with heroin at 8 years old. And that's not an excuse for bad behavior. But what it is it's all those social determinants that factor in how we live our life. And I remember the first day I went into prison, I came home that night and I phoned my mom. And I said, thank you for putting me in good schools. Because we grew up sort of lower middle class. We didn't have a lot of money. But my parents always tried to put me into a school, public school, outside of the area we were in. So in a more elevated area. And I did thank them for that, because I think it helped me stay out of that element. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's interesting that even in the earlier days, which, you know, might be very different to the grand speaking and writing that you do now, it sounds like you were still somebody who was trying to help them create change in their life.
You know, and that's, and I'll be honest with you, all of those experiences, and I write about a couple of them in my book, and working with people living on the street who are drug users and stuff. And it's really framed my context for change in that I really believe that if guys in jail who've done some of the most awful things can create little pieces of good change in their world, if, you know, there's a story in my book about teaching sexual health to nuns, Catholic sisters,
who are these radical
women.
Well, now I have a whole host of new questions.
Yeah.
You know, scrap the rest.
Yeah, these were, and you know, not everyone's had great experiences with Catholic sisters, but these were, you know, I call them the Sound of Music types of nuns who weren't trying to convert anybody, who were just really there to do good. And they were going to be doing outreach to sex workers, drug users, you know, all this stuff. And they needed to know the terms that these people were going to use. Yeah. So, you know, these women, I really believe if you could teach sexual health to nuns, you can get anybody to step into organizational change, you know, because you're breaking through your self-imposed limitations. And those self-imposed limitations are our greatest barrier to change.
Okay, same question. What would people be surprised at when it comes to teaching sexual health to nuns or even doing learning and development with nuns, period? Like, what would people be surprised by?
That when they're focused on creating change that matters and doing good on the planet, they can put aside their own values and beliefs and learn something new that supersedes and that is for the greater good. And I think, you know, one of the activity I talk about in the book is how I have them, you know, we're in a group, flip chart paper, clinical terms at the top for body parts and things that go on between our neck and our knees. And they have to write down all the street terms they know about those words. And oh my gosh, they knew words I did not know.
This is fabulous. And
the purpose was to desensitize them so they wouldn't be shocked and go, Bailey, you shouldn't use that word.
Right. You know what? It's almost like get it out in the classroom where you're in a safe environment, supposed to learn, supposed to work through these biases and judgments so that when you are in front of a student, that doesn't happen. Like, it seems really smart.
And that's exactly it. And I think that that framework of teaching all those years, you know, those difficult topics, because that was my first year from the early 90s till early 2000s, I taught really difficult topics like that. Mm. And, you know, I really honed my teeth on how to frame things and make difficult things relatable to the average person. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, my strength still today is, you know, being able to take something complex and weird maybe and make it palatable for people that might be a little about it.
Yeah. So like, what's changing for you right now? What's going on in your life now? I don't think that you're doing those kinds of trainings
anymore. They still make good stories though, but I don't talk about that much on stage because there's so much context around that has to be around the conversations.
Yeah. So what is changing for you right now? What's going on?
What's changing? I think, you know, it's really, you know, I've been doing this for a while, like doing workshops and, you know, learning development and then speaking. And, you know, now I still do a blend of both. And the biggest thing I think, and it's sort of, I don't know if it is changing. It's sort of coming full circle back to owning what I really do well. Mm-hmm. So in the world that, you know, you and I live in of, you know, speaking and workshops and writing and consulting and, you know, I have a lot of lived experience from, you know, leading large scale change initiatives and organizations as well. I start to compare myself. Oh, I really should be doing that. Or I really should be doing this. Or, you know, I really should do my talk like this. No. And I think the challenge that those of us who come from the corporate world, because, you know, after social justice work, there's all this corporate stuff for 20 years, is shedding that skin and pulling it away. And you know, I mentor entrepreneurs in a volunteer capacity in a number of places, and it's always about shedding that corporate skin and going, what is my unique thing what's my own brand of magic that I bring? Yeah. And what's been changing the last 5 months is just being in that and doing it and not caring what other what other speakers or things do. Like, what's my brand of magic? Live it.
And I imagine that's been working, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I had a record.
You don't even know.
I had a record year last year.
Yeah, oh, year. Congratulations. That makes me so happy.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. And it's, you know, I measure that sort of, and you know this because you do similar work to what I do. When you, people like us are putting ourselves out there all the time, we're evaluated and mm-hmm. it's like acting, right? We audition through video, or some people aren't going to hire me because I don't have any hair. Some people will hire you because you have hair. And, you know, and that's the truth, you know, that because people are looking for a mix when they're creating programs, and not, it's not just about credibility and background. And I think it's really about, you know, I measure it based upon how I step into whatever I'm doing and how I step out of it and how the audience is feeling and learning and out of it. And, you know, when you have a run of a number, and I'm very self-critical, as many people are, like who do the work we do, we always want to get better. Mm-hmm. And I'm just learning to just be in my groove and, you know, just do it. Because when I just bring more of myself and bring it out, people want more. And if you watch reality TV, any reality competition show, what do you hear from the judges? We want to see more of you.
Yeah. And there's something in the you, even I'm sure listeners can already hear how much personality you naturally have. And when you try to fit that into some corporate box, it's just going to be inauthentic. You're going to feel it.
Totally. Like, it, what's really funny is about 5 or 6 years ago, I had a run of about 3 or 4 construction conferences. And construction folks aren't usually my general audience. Mm-hmm. And what's so funny is I have another run of construction conferences coming up next week where I'm like flying to Florida, then flying directly from Florida up to Alberta.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. To speak the next day, and then another one the next day on the West Coast. And, you know, construction's a great place for me because it takes me out of my zone and it forces me to shed everything. And what I learned 5 years ago, because I thought, oh, I'll have to really butch it up and be very on stage. Mm. And the more I was myself on stage, the more they loved it. Because I didn't need to be like a foreman or a this or a that.
Right.
They hired me because of me.
Yeah, because you know the things that you know.
And I bring really it amazing. To them in a way that's accessible. And so what? Next week is the same thing. So.
Oh, I now time. After that, I'm going to be dying to hear like how it felt different from the first run.
Well, you know what it is that, and I have this when I work, you know, I did a big event last week for senior leaders in pharma. So I'm talking, you know, PhDs, MDs, you know, like, and really smart people that make oodles of money and that are really creating change on the planet when it comes to healthcare, you know, developing new drugs to combat diseases and improving patient outcomes, all this stuff that I come from healthcare. And I get nervous even going into that. I'm like, oh my God, they're all so smart. And, you know, this is after like years of doing this and working in healthcare for 10 years, consciously talk myself down. So yeah, you know, even after all this, I'm still doing that.
Was there a moment or a time in your life where you where you felt like, you know what, I'm over it. I'm just going to be me.
I'm sort of at that moment-ish now. So it's been a progression over the last. So yeah, I did a keynote last September that I didn't really like. And it landed, but I didn't think it was great. And they booked it privately through me, thank goodness. So I didn't need to tell any bureau. I didn't think it was that great. I mean, the client liked it, but I just didn't, you know, they might've thought it was good, but I just thought, I don't want to do that one again. Like, meaning it wasn't a connection with me in the audience. It just wasn't. And I knew it was going to be walking.
No.
I should have said no to it in the first place. Right after that, I said, you're not doing that crap again. You're going in. You're not doing. You're just going to do what you do well. And I customize everything I do for the client. I incorporate their DNA, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not saying this to pump myself up. I'm just saying I have not done one bad one since October. They've just been like, shh.
Perfect.
And I say that not to, but it's about stepping into my own, right? And that's where I'm at. And yeah. So I got nervous last week with pharma because I hadn't done a keynote for a few weeks. but stepped into it, talked down. So then next week, I had to talk Greg. So yeah, I'm sort of in that zone now, but I still find even with all the stuff I've done, and it's still, because I want it to, coming from learning and development, you from this world too know, I want, it's not about me, it's about what are we going to get the audience? What do they want? What do they need? How's it going to be perfect for them?
Mm-hmm. Well, what have been some of the changes? Because you mentioned, you've been in this industry a long time, and even though we're in a similar industry, there are many, in many ways, Hamza and I would look up to you to see, of course, right? And also, I want to think some things through with you today, but what are some changes that you've seen in this industry, maybe even in the world of work, over that time?
Well, I think there's big changes. I think, and I think there's a few things that I'll mention. That one is, I think there's been a really great push around having more speakers that are diverse. And by that, I don't just mean skin color, ethnicity, culture. I mean everything ranging from, mobility through to the full range. And I think people are starting to play with that, because when I used to do team development work, and diversity is about personality too, like there's so many layers of diversity, that we always say diverse teams, and again, it's not just diversity, equity, inclusion
stuff, existence.
Diverse ways of thinking, diverse personalities bring layers and bring productivity, because the world is diverse. And so I think that's really super positive. That really makes me excited. And the other thing I'm really noticing, and this is probably post-COVID, is a much, and this is my world, so it might be different for you, Hamza, and other speakers. My world, people are wanting really more targeted, almost, speaking gigs. Like I'm doing, right now I seem to be doing a lot of senior leader, smaller, like 80 to 150, really targeted events. And the big thing, that I bring that people seem to really want now is they don't want me to talk on stage for an hour and go blah, 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 blah. And I haven't climbed Mount Everest, so I'm not going to talk up for an hour about how great that was and my challenges. I like to do things with the group.
I do too.
Yeah.
I completely agree. I have seen this shift too, is the move towards more, honestly, what was natural in a classroom, like how you would design adult learning, not how you would design the celebrity speaking.
Thank you.
100%. We're going in that direction. And you want to know what? I was just at an event, in December where I was with other speakers, and a lot of other speakers like yourself also happen to own some kind of business that might be an appendage or however else. And I said to them, would you hire, straight up, would you hire a keynote for 20 grand to speak to your company for an hour? No. Well, there you go. I don't think the younger generation would.
No. I think, I come from the adult learning space, as you know, both of us do. And, I did my degree in that and la, la, la. And that's the magic that I bring to the keynote stage, is that interactive, piece of, and we're not going to do a workshop. It's, keynote's different. It's more inspirational. It's more, there's more stuff in it, more storytelling. Mm-hmm. It's more short snippets and stuff.
It's like inciting the action, but.
Yes. And the thing that I've done years ago, which I'm back into, because I thought, maybe I shouldn't do as much interactive stuff because other keynote speakers don't. And then I stopped, and then it just was natural for me. Mm-hmm. And now, I try to get an hour and 15 instead of an hour, which I'll often get now, because I'll do a couple of different things, and it really makes it come home. And I think
absolutely
where you and I come together on this is that, the adult learning model is not, I'm the expert.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The adult learning model is, you have a lot of expertise, I have some expertise, we're going to meet together somewhere and create this. And I set that up in my keynotes. I'll say to people,
I love that.
Yeah. I'll say to people, I am not the expert in your world. You are.
Mm-hmm. So you know what? I say the exact same thing. I'm like, that's not my job to know construction here. I know you know, whatever. It might be change. I know change. Like,
yeah.
Let's talk change in construction. Like, we'll put our brains together.
And it's really about, I want to collect the wisdom in the room. So I do fun, like if I have 1,000 people, I'll run out to the, I get them to pair up or do something. And I run out like Oprah and run around like a maniac and collect some of the wisdom. And you know what? I got speaker coaching a number of years ago, which, you know, I'm just like, Greg, stop trying to get coaching from people. Even though I'm like you, I want to learn.
Yeah.
This person said, Greg, when you go off stage, it really lowers your credibility. And so then for about a year, I became a really crappy speaker, I like to say. Mm-hmm. And then I consulted with a friend of mine who's a very high-end speaker person. He said, you go off stage. I like to go off stage because it normalizes me. And yeah, of course, I've always gone off stage before. And now I go off stage again.
Yeah. So you just let them, you let them get in your flow, man. But we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah, enough. You know, a lot of this is about owning our own wisdom, right? Mm-hmm.
And just you know, when you talked about how like the industry's become more diverse over time, I think part of that is also like a permission to allow those parts of you that are different than the audience, that are different than that corporation, which it might sound corny to some, but those are really the things that make you shine. And
yeah. And why are they hiring you? Like,
yeah, if, they can hire many people.
Yeah, like if I hire you, Bailey, to come speak to one of my groups, I'm expecting to get Bailey, not Bailey put through the mishmash machine to come out some corporate speak woman that's going to blah, blah. I want Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And for you, I mean, how has your identity, because you talk a lot about social justice and even your own identity in some respects would be one of the identities that wasn't allowed to be there 40 years ago.
Oh, for sure.
You know, so like, how has that influenced your career? And is that constantly coming into modern day?
Yeah. So I think as a gay guy, it you know, I think it influences my career still, which is like, I don't want to get up in front of big construction people because they're going to beat me up. You know, it's that little kid that comes out. Right. And, so I think that's a lot of where some of that imposter syndrome comes from. And I think there's a big thing and, you know, as a kid, you know, it was not okay to be a little gay kid, even though I was a raving little gay kid. You know, my mom knew when I was like 5,
baby.
You know, I had a G.I. Joe camper that I redecorated and built a room. I mean, I loved architecture and homes. And so I was like building homes and stuff. So, but I did redecorate it. So, you know, that's a little stereotypical, but I was very, you know, I loved
it. Obviously it came in handy. You literally just redecorated your Airbnb.
I know. Well, you know, what's so funny is I tell people, if you really want to live a really great adult life, find what you love to do as a kid and do it as an adult. Hmm. So when I was a kid, I loved to build houses. So of course I used to buy and sell real estate for fun. And then the other thing I did was teach. I'd sit down with the kids and teach them math at 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, now as a teacher, you know, I teach now in a different capacity. So, but yeah, as a gay kid, so as this little gay kid, and you learn to hide, you know, and so on. And it wasn't until between grade 10 and 11, I met a really cool girl in high school named Rosalie. And she said, Greg, I'm going to take you to my hairstylist. We're going to get rid of your glasses and get contact lenses. And so, true story, between grade 10 and 11, I got rid of my glasses and got contact lenses, got my hair done nice because you have really nice hair. And when I came back to school in grade 11, my popularity went up because I wasn't trying to hide anymore. And I wasn't trying to be somebody I wasn't. And I wasn't going, oh, I'm gay, but I'm just being who I am. And and by grade 12, all of my friends were boys at school, which was not normal for a gay kid. Mm-hmm. And I was very rarely, I mean, I was 6 feet tall, but I just sort of stepped into my own. And that's been a life lesson really since then. It's really the more you are yourself, the more people will like you. And yet the gay thing still, I mean, I lose business, I'm sure, because of it, and I get business because of it, right? You know, so it's the whole picture to the stage, and you know, it informs my work today completely about, you know, how I'm going to be on stage. And, you know, I used to think with construction, I have to butch it up and act very heterosexual and straight on stage. And then I realized if I'm just myself, that's just fine. So, yeah, I think, I mentor entrepreneurs and with the CGLCC, the National LGBT Chamber of Commerce. You know, entrepreneurs, you know, LGBT folks are, you know, they go through this, am I going to be discriminated against? And in Canada, it's very different than the U.S., you know. In Canada, you can't be fired for that stuff. But in the U.S., you still can be. So it's...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can be many, many places in the U.S. I still have a lot to learn about the U.S. Yeah. I still have conversations with people that can't come out at work.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, I'm saying a lot to learn, but even in the news and literally just the last year, there's been more anti-LGBTQ plus bills than I think at any other time. So
yeah,
I know that, like, I'm sorry that that has to be something that you have to consider when you're taking business, you know?
Well, my first job, you know, one of my first big corporate jobs I had back in 2006, my boss wanted me to go do some work in Bahrain. And at the time, I don't know what it is now, it was completely illegal to be gay over there. And you could be like stoned or, you know, something like that, or put in jail. So I had to go. I've just been hired. I'm like, I can't go. And he's like, why? I'm like, because I'm gay and it's legal to be gay. And he's like, well, you're not going to have sex with everybody while you're there. And I'm like, no.
I know this. You know this.
Yeah, I know this. You know this. But it's about identity. It's not about practicing, right? So... Yeah, it's there, but I'm very lucky. You know, I feel very safe, and you know, I don't have any things. But it informs my, it certainly informs my my lens of, you know, again, that social justice, social change, creating environments for people to feel safe to have conversations. It does inform that.
Yeah, and I think for people listening right now, like, you are already identified the theme, and that's no surprise, but even just hearing parts of your story that I've never heard about before, it does sound like you're entering, like, you know, maybe Gen Z would say, like, your main character era, where you're the zone of genius, where who you are on the inside is the environment has shifted, you've entered in a new phase of self-assurance, and that's being received back to you. And I'm getting shivers, so.
Yeah, you know, it really is that. It's, you know, it gets to the place when I was younger. So my mentors have always been like business mentors, and it have always been women who are about 20 years older than me. And whether it's been a nurse mentor, though I'm not, I worked in nursing education because I have an education background. My dear friend Lois is in her 80s now and running a hospice and keeping care of her 92-year-old husband. Or, you know, other women that who've been my mentors. You know, a constant theme with them has been, you know, when you get to be an old lady, I'm using their language. When you get to be an old lady, you don't really give a crap what other people think. So don't wait. And that was the message. And, you know, I'm 57 now and I'm not waiting. This is, you know, and that's been my theme for the last number of years. Like, I'm not waiting. I'm stepping into my own. I'm owning it. And, you know, hopefully people don't need to wait till they're 57 all the time. But I always knew I was going to be, I always knew in my life that when I was younger was going to be all the hands-on, hard, you know, corporate on the street, like the real sort of tangible work to build the expertise and get the degrees and all that hoo-ha. And I always knew that this part of my life would be that really just, you know, when you're in midlife, it's about really stepping into that next trajectory. And it's not like this. It's like this, you know.
Yeah, like the hockey stick.
Yeah.
And, well, I think that some people listening, like, I really hope so anyways, and I'll have to amplify this part on social media because I want people to hear your story. And maybe they are 20 right now, but I want them to think, like, don't wait. I mean, there are things... Even if you're being hired in a boardroom and you work at a bank, like, you, the thing that you can bring that no other teller, no other accountant, no other thing can bring is literally the recipe that made you, you.
Exactly. And I think the piece about that too, you know, and I work with a, I like to surround myself with a lot of younger folks because they keep me on my toes and know how to work a bunch of things that I don't know how to work. And one of the reasons I really like that is, you know, there's conversations so much now about generative AI and my jobs are going to be taken away and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I tell people it's crap. You know, from the research I've seen and from my experience, you know, tools will never replace wisdom, ever.
I mean,
tools will help us do parts of our job better. They'll help us. You still have to, you're going to become a better editor. You're going to have to become more wise to determine what to put in. You're still going to need to understand complexity because generative AI can only do so much. And it can't do decision making. So the abilities of strategic thinking, decision making, conflict resolution, and all the wisdom that comes from our work, that's going to even be more valuable as this other stuff starts to become easier.
Well, do you know what? We'll have to redo this again soon, because my whole doctoral research right now is about how generative AI can support leaders in doing what leaders already have to do. And decision making is actually one of those chief things.
Totally. It can
speaking of changes that people should be ready for, when I first reached out to you, you know, I said, like, this idea of navigating change. And one thing you said was something I resonate with, which is that you prefer the term change ready as opposed to navigating change.
Yeah, like,
what was your thinking around that?
Well, and I've even moved away from that now. So the great thing about where I am in my life is I get to do a lot of research. I get to experiment. I get to talk to a lot of people I think are experts and theorists from, you know, academics through to, you know, hands-on practitioners. And I'm really playing with the concept of being future ready, because future readiness, for me, being change ready is very reactive. And it means we're getting ready. We can respond to whatever comes. And, you know, we learned that in COVID. And one of the pieces I talk a lot is that if we can get through COVID, there's not much we can't do. And we want to look at what those skills and abilities and qualities we use there and apply those to changes coming up. Whereas future readiness incorporates that and takes into account the more strategic forward thinking piece. Mm-hmm. Because people say to me all the time, I want to know what the future work is and blah, blah, blah. So I speak on that a lot in terms of just sharing the trend. And then I say, you know what? Those are all going to change. So who cares? Why don't we focus on making our teams future ready, making ourselves future ready, making our organizations future ready? Because when we do that, we can handle whatever comes up, because it's all going to change. And you need to know trends and patterns and blah, 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 because it helps you plan. But just like a plan, it's like, you know, astrology or tarot cards. You know, reading your astrology and doing tarot cards does not automatically predict the future, just like doing a strategic plan or change management plan or project plan. They're the tarot cards of business. Hopefully they work. If they don't, they rarely go as planned.
Hopefully we made our predictions correct. But if not, then there are all these host of skills. And I know for sure firsthand that you building up your ability to be resilient or adaptable or grit, these things would help no matter what the future holds. I'm at, like, you know, I imagine you agree.
It is. And future readiness is about being proactive about it and not just waiting. Change ready is about, you know, okay, we're ready. We're good. We built our change muscles. We're ready to rock it out of the park. Future ready is really about being strategic, proactive, stepping in, anticipating, initiating, creating. Because, you know, one of the reasons I wrote my book was I wanted to give people a formula to create change that matters on the planet. Because I'm lucky to work with organizations that are tackling the biggest issues, you know, housing, healthcare, education. You know, those are big issues.
Do you find that the themes of, say, an organization trying to create change are similar to just, you know, one of my listeners and an average person doing or going about our day? Are they the same themes when we're trying to create change in our own life?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things I really believe is that, you know, there's a lot of big organizations and big people that get named for creating change. And yet some of the biggest changes come from people like you, me, the people listening, who are creating change in their world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, creating change in our world can be something as simple as not responding negatively to something, to a hassle that's happening, and just making your life go a little better. It can be, you know, how we're going to interact differently at work. It can be giving people practical tips. Mm-hmm. There's all these little, you know, often micro moments that happen that people are creating change on the planet. They'll never get recognized for it. Mm-hmm. But it's the person, it can be, you know, sort of, you know, cliched. It could be the person at the grocery store who is telling you to have a great day when you're feeling like crap. I mean, that's a very micro thing. It can be something at work. It can be the work you do. It can be, that's, you know, if we really focus on creating change that matters, I think that that has a ripple effect on the planet. And I think the planet is, we're being called, all of us now, to create change that matters, because things, we're becoming more polarized. We're becoming, you know, often more separate, people say, even though I believe there's a lot of commonality and believe most people want to play in the middle somewhere. And I think it's up to all of us to try to understand those differences. And, you know, I have friends who have different political beliefs than me. There's some values that are non-negotiable. Like if you're misogynist, racist, blah, 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 we're not going to be friends. Mm-hmm. But we can have some different different beliefs on a spectrum where we don't, like gun control, for example. I have friends who are avid gun users who love, you know, shooting and hunting and blah, 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 blah. And I'm not there, but we can come together and have these dialogues. And I always say to them, we'd be really good politicians. We can agree to disagree. And I think
I know. It's never those people that become politicians. Actually, you know what? To be fair, I actually know some politicians like throughout the years who are people who tried. And I mean, honestly, I've never met one who went in saying, I'm going to mess this up. It was like the system that got in the way. They weren't like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's about... You know, I think when we focus on areas of commonality, and it doesn't mean we have to tolerate, it doesn't mean we have to believe that they're right or think, but when we can just come together and have the dialogues in constructive ways, it sounds so stupid and simplistic when I say it, and yet it's the most difficult thing to do.
I think it's the most difficult thing for most people. And there's like a spectrum to this. It's there's even an element of if people think that they're having a discussion with someone who's politically different, that they are condoning it, that they are, that they feel guilt for it, that their community wouldn't understand why they're doing this. But in fact, these people vote. Like, in fact, those bridge makers, those mediators, you'd want to support at all costs, because that's actually how you're going to see movement in anything that you're trying to do.
Well, and I think, you know, the big piece about having, and this is about dialogue at work, it's for any of your listeners who are, you know, self-employed or starting their own business, or students, or people that are entrepreneurs or working in organizations. All of us, and I include myself in this, when we want to get people engaged in our ideas so they take action, and that's what I'm about. It's all about, it's not just about having an idea. It's about, let's take action on this. So whether it's trying to get people to, you know, do a new process at work, or whether it's people to buy your product or service, or whether it's to get people to shift their thinking about something that's important to you. We have to take the pressure off that it's not about converting other people to our ideas and to our side. And that it's not about selling and convincing. And this is going to be a no-brainer for you because you live this. It's about having an educator mindset, which is very much coming in, going, I've got some info, you've got some info, let's find a way to come together and talk about it. Because this is the thing that people, all of us, including me, have had to, I'm still learning this, and I'm still learning to practice this at home. Because sometimes the stuff I know at work, I don't practice at home. You can't make people do anything. You can't change people. And that's really easy to say that. Mm-hmm. And at work, you know, people say, I want to make people do this. I want to change them. You can't. Everyone has a choice.
And ideally, you can motivate them to change for themselves.
Totally. We can create an environment for them to change. Yet it's their call. They have their own agency. Yeah. They have their own, you have a choice to engage with me. There's consequences in the workplace if you don't, maybe positive or negative, but you have a choice. You have a choice not to show up at work on time. There's consequences. You have a choice, you know, and if we have dialogues that are about trying to understand other people's point of view, that's where we can start to create the change that matters. you know, Rumi, the 12th century or 13th century, I can't remember, or 11th century.
Big fan.
Yeah, me
right
too.
Over here, actually.
Oh, good. The Sufi mystics said this, you know, out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there.
I posted that last week. I'm not kidding.
No way.
I can't believe that. Yeah, that you just said that exact one.
Well, and you know, I have the quote in my book, and this is the premise, sort of my core of my work. I believe that it's in that field where we can create change that matters.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I've learned over the years, so even so far, that there's a lot of things that get in the way for people that are sometimes invisible. Like, even if they feel that they're on the right side, that they're maybe have their own traumas and things, family traumas, histories that prevent them from being able to be that mediator and to be in that field. And I'm just like, I know, but someone's got to be in the field. So if it can't be you, that's all right. Like, there's all change, I feel like, comes with different roles. But I mean, I guess one question I have for you, for the everyday folk listening who aren't guiding major organizations, is like, why do you think people often find it so hard to adapt to change?
Because we don't have the energy. You know, people will often put down people's comfort zone, and you're in your comfort zone. Your comfort zones are great because you're at your most productive in your comfort zone. You're using the least amount of energy to do the maximum amount of work. Mm-hmm. When change happens, unless you agree with it, or unless it's initiated by you, because we all love change, it's our idea. You know, if it's your idea, I may not like it as much, but when it's my idea, I love it. I want to do
Perfect.
It. Right? So we respond very differently to change that's our idea versus someone else's idea. So first, you know, it's regulatory, legislative, comes down from above. You know, with you and Hamza, you might want to spend money one way, you might want to spend money some way else. But if it's your idea, you're ready to go to the store that weekend and do it.
Yeah.
Whereas Hamza might be like, I'm not doing that, Bailey. Like, I don't want it. And then you're like, and then I have to try to make him do it with me. And, you know, and that's where the tension rises. And that's where, you know, it's like, can't you just do what I want to do? Because I don't have the energy, the mental, emotional, physical, spiritual capacity, because there's so much going on. So I think that is the biggest thing. And I think it's about realizing that, you know, your time is the ultimate currency that you have, and that you have to prioritize. And I used to relentlessly prioritize your time so that you can have the ability to step into that change. Because I do believe it's an energy. I think it's two things. It's about energy and also whether you want to, or whether you think it's a good idea or not.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that, in terms of relentlessly taking care of your time, I am too, but when we teach productivity and time management, or peak performance, whatever you want to call it, skills camp, one of the things that we use is actually Hamza's pyramid of productivity, which is time, energy, and attention. And we say, you know, setting the time to do something is one thing, but if you have no energy in that time, it's still not productive towards your goals. And then even if you have set the time and you do have energy, if your attention is using it on social media, you're still not productive towards your goals.
Totally.
But actually, when you get into energy management and attention management, this is my favorite part, because you can actually make more of it.
Yeah. And it really is about being very clear that you can't do everything, you know, and that's, you know, that's one of the things that I think is really important for people to realize, is that, you know, not everything that comes through your email or through your desk is urgent and important. It is just not. I have a pile right here. And I've had a pile on my desk when I worked in government and when
and
I worked
your
in
personal life.
Yeah. And it's called the non-urgent, non-important pile. And I just put stuff there. And once a year I go through it, it might be two or three things that were that important. And I'm always amazed at the amount of crap that comes through that other people might think are important, or other people might think are urgent, but that are not. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, thank goodness I didn't do this pile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then what would be some strategies that you would give people who are maybe afraid of what the future changes are, I guess, of the future and the changes that are coming with that future? What are some strategies that they can put in place to be a more future-ready person?
Yeah. So I think what happens is when people think about the future, they get worried, right? Mm-hmm. Because we want to know what the future holds. That's what we do. We go to astrology and tarot cards and all that. We go, what's the future hold? And we get worried. Mm-hmm. And, you know, worries are just made up negative stories. You know, worries are made up negative stories. And I'm not saying don't listen to worries, because people's worries can be valid or not valid. We want to listen to worries. And if we want people to take action, I believe in converting worries to risks, so grounding them in fact and asking some questions. You know, what's the likelihood of this happening, low, medium, or high? Mm. What's the impact if it does, low, medium, or high? Because we want to quantify it. You know, the research shows that we tend to worry more about risks. We unless they're quantified, when we're able to put a low, medium, or high or something, it reduces our worry for whatever reason that is. And, you know, then we can look at ways to prevent it from happening and the ways to maybe a plan B. So I really love to ground things, in fact. And that's from my own experience, because when I was in grade 5, I remember being picked up by some parent, you know, drive me home or something. And she was like, "You're such a worrywart." And I was.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not a worrywart now, because I've built that skill to ground it, in fact. And I think that is a real, if people can, you just remember they're made up negative stories. That's all they are.
I think that is actually really useful for people. And even if you've, so if you're listening and you've not applied this to your own context yet, because let's say your kid is leaving and going off to college. Like, it could be any example, right? It's not just the workplace. It's like, okay, well, what am I actually worried about here? Am I worried about their safety? Am I worried that they're going to distance themselves from me? So then if you'd use your strategy, it's like, well, what is actually the likelihood that they are going to be unsafe in this dorm room? Low, medium, probably pretty low, or I would have heard many more stories about this in the news, you know, if students weren't safe.
Yeah, and they're not going to that school.
Unless, what's the likelihood that they're going to distance themselves from me? Well, if you have a good relationship with your kid, you know what? Let's put it high. Let's even say medium.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then what are we going to do about that? You know what? I'm going to talk to my kid. I'm going to say, call me once a week. I'm going to say, let's have a text, you know?
Absolutely. What's our prevention plan? Are we going to prevent this from happening? And I think, so the thing is this too, it's really easy for me to say this now because I'm not under pressure. But when I'm under pressure to perform, as are many of our listeners, whether it's home at work or something bad happens, you know, once that cortisol and adrenaline starts going through our body and floods our brain, we lose working memory. And it's really hard to remember when we lose that working memory to like ground things in fact, because we're so riled up. And, you know, I'll often tell people, because this is my experience, we need to pay attention to what's happening in our bodies. Because what's happening in our bodies determines how we're making decisions, how we're making sense of information, how we're remembering how to handle something. Mm-hmm. It brings us, you know, when we're under pressure and if we're riled up for whatever reason, all that stuff's happening in our body. You know, we're not making the best decisions. We're being reactive, which can be the best decision at that moment. If a car's coming, you're going to pull your kid out of the way really fast without thinking about it, because that's the reactive. Yeah, when we're under pressure, and it's hard to remember that worries are made up negative stories, because we're like, oh my gosh, but
it hasn't happened yet. Literally has not happened. So
people will say to me, oh, you have a risk. Like, and I do, I like to take a lot of risks. Like, I used to jump off mountains with parachutes.
Oh,
and
good Lord.
You know, I love going ice swimming in lakes and crazy things. And, you know, on a day-to-day basis, my risks are managed. I'm very risk averse.
But okay, you know what? I'm going to highlight that one too as a strategy, like, for people, because, you know, if you know now that when you're worried, or when, you know, stressors are going on at home or at work, and you want to be future ready, I like this idea. You know, one of the things that my coach says is practice who you are being. That every day when you're not in the worries, but a change is coming, that's where you want to practice who you are, and you go through that same risk assessment so that when your brain does shut off, you've already made it normal.
Well, you hit such a good point, because one of the things we know about change is it doesn't discriminate between what's going on personally or professionally.
Yeah, like, it doesn't exactly.
You're going to act like this here and this here. So what I'll often tell people is practice building up the way you respond or way you initiate or the way you plan change in non-business mission critical ways. So when you're, you know, practice how you respond to hassles. When you miss your flight, how do you respond? Yes, you're under pressure.
100%.
How are you responding? Or when you're in the lineup at the grocery store and someone cuts you off, treat hassles as exercise was what one of my coaches said. And it's a great way to practice, you know, like I give you a great example. When I used to drive to work many years ago in an office north of Toronto, I would get up in the morning, true story, and I'd get on the highway, and by the time I got to work, I'd be in a really bad mood. It happened every day for probably a year because people would intentionally cut me off. That person cut me off, and I'd be yelling. And I'd get to the office, and people, you know, everybody listening has probably gone through this in some capacity, whether it's taking the subway, whether it's missing something, whether it's, you know, getting angry with someone you live with or work with or play with, whatever. And, you know, I get to the office and my team would be like, why is Greg in a bad mood? People's productivity would drop because I'm in a bad mood.
Yeah.
And eventually I had to start responding differently. Mm-hmm. So stuff like, are these people really intentionally cutting me off?
No.
So it becomes laughable now when I look back. So what's interesting is, and it took me maybe about 6 months to shift that. When I'm in a car with people yelling at drivers, I'm like, why are they yelling? I don't care.
Oh my gosh, I know.
My response is so different. Like little things don't bother me anymore, but I've had to learn that. And I learned that outside so that when the big things happen, mm-hmm. I still get stressed. I still get worried, but I handle it more efficiently.
Yeah. Well, I am going to change course a little here, pun intended, and we're going to go into a couple of segments that are in each podcast. And
cool. The
one that I've chose for you, you know, because there's one that changes every episode, and for this one, it's called On Second Thought.
Okay.
Now, I just thought this one would be perfect for given our top, like our subject today. And in this segment, On Second Thought, we discuss one thing that the guest's thinking has significantly evolved around over time. So you thought one way before, and through knowledge or experience, you've come to think quite differently about it. So what is one thing in your career that you've come to think differently about? And how did that change happen?
The first thing that comes to mind is something we've talked about already, which is about, I used to think when I was younger, I would say the negative about, I would say as a bear, I wouldn't say a negative person, but I certainly, and I still can lean to the more pessimistic side of things. And I think what I really, really learned over the years, and this comes, you know, whether it's from working in a corporate sector, whether it's working in nursing, whether it's working with guys in jail or people on the street, is that most people are not horrible people. Most people are not awful. Most people are not bad, whatever label you want to put on it. Mm-hmm. And now I'm not a Pollyanna. I wrote an article years ago on the tyranny of positive thinking, because I believe most people apply positive thinking at the wrong time. So I don't believe, you know, in totally papering things over with positivity in any sense of the imagination. But what I do believe is that there's a lot of stuff going on in people's lives that we don't know about. And in the old days, I'd be like, if they just listened to me, their life would be better.
Yeah.
And now I know, you know, and you know, there's many people in my life, I'm like, I don't know what they're doing, and I don't know what's going on them, and I wouldn't do that. I don't know what the heck's going on there. And I've really tried, and I'm still learning this, but really most people are not out to be goofs or whatever label you want to put on it. And I'm still learning that.
But I do think that would be one of the most like liberating, life-changing beliefs that you could change, which is, imagine if I just assumed ignorance over malevolence.
Yeah. And, you know, I really think that when we do that, I think it creates a different energy with ourselves. And I don't mean woo-woo energy, but physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, all that energy, that the electrical energy that courses through our body as well. I really think it sets the stage for a better dialogue, conversation, using the right language, you know, all that sort of stuff. Because I think it's, you know, one of the things I has bothered me a lot over the last number of years, and some of your listeners may take issue with it. That's okay. You can argue with me all you want. Ooh. This is my belief. There's a lot of things that people will fall back on and say, it's all about the impact. It's not about your intent. It's about what's the impact on me? What you said really hurt me. And, you know, now, you know, I do a lot of work in the often teaching people who are in the diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility space on how to frame these topics so people can hear us. Because people have their values, morals, beliefs. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's about impact. And I think this is what's even more important. And people can argue with me all they want. And they're not going to convert me to their side of the thing.
That's all right. We can think it through.
Focus on the spirit of intent. Are you using these words to intentionally hurt me? Mm-hmm. Or are you using them because you just don't know any better? Mm-hmm. So if I focus on the spirit of intent, we can get into that space that Rumi talks about. And we can actually have a dialogue.
As an educator, and I think that, you know, I've found this also in my justice work, like not all people who are socially minded or even in the justice space are educators. And that's fine, because there's a whole set of skills that we know that we've practiced with people to help them arrive at different conclusions. And just because you believe in something strongly doesn't necessarily mean that you are the one to teach it. And to your point, I will say, I think it was almost like more like five, maybe even between 5 and 10 years ago, where people were focused on the impact. And my belief is just because, you know, there was no focus on that for a long time.
Yeah,
but now absolutely. I feel like we're coming back to, if you're as an educator, if your intent is good, wow, I can work with that. Trust me, I can work with that. I can definitely work on mechanics if the intent is good.
Well, and I'll often say to people, you know, don't teach on things. Yeah, you know, this is in my book because it comes from all my work around, if you want to create change that matters, you have to get a PhD in yourself. You have to know, what is the stuff that ticks you off? What's the stuff that's going to poke your buttons? What's the stuff that's going to rile you up? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was working with a guy, a trans guy who teaches diversity, equity, inclusion workshops. And he's an excellent educator and speaker. And what was really interesting, he said to me, he said, he created the environment where someone said, can I use this word to describe X, whatever the word was? And he immediately said, no, that word is transphobic and homophobic and la, 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 and shut down, mm-hmm. you know, all. And now I said to this person, I said, you know, that person, you created such a great environment for this person to ask the question. Mm-hmm. So let's look at a different language. And so we just came up with some language and say, you know, some people can perceive those words as being transphobic, right. homophobic. I suggest using these instead. So it creates that environment of openness.
Yeah.
And when you focus on the spirit of intent, because he was like, but it really offends people. I'm like, it does. And if you want to create change and create learning, keep the channel open. That person, you created a great environment for that person to say, can I use this word? Right. Not many people can do that.
And that's the educator side of it. And you know, in my work with social justice advocates or activists, I think there's a learning there almost, which is like, I understand you're literally trying to build awareness very often, right? But that doesn't mean that you're the educator or that you have even the energy to be that person all the time because of everything you're going through.
Totally. So you don't have to be.
Yeah.
You know, I'll often tell people, you know, it's not my job to ever educate everybody about LGBTQ stuff. Like people say, can you speak on LGBT? I'm like, no. I can speak as me as being a white gay man as this. I cannot speak about every diversity thingy on the, and I don't even speak about being LGBT because I can only speak about me because I'm not even, I can help people who are experts in that area how to teach that and talk about it better because I'm an educator. But I can't do that. And I think when we focus on the spirit of intent and ask this question, is this person intentionally saying this to offend me, to upset me, or is intentionally using this word, and whether it's diversity equity, doesn't need to be that. It could be even in dialogue at work when someone says something and be like, don't say that. What's the intent? Mm-hmm. If the intent wasn't malicious, let's just converse.
Yeah.
And then it creates peace and our productivity stays up and we stay, not everything has to be like Real Housewives of Beverly Hills or one of those shows where we confront everybody and yell and scream all the time.
Yeah, it does. It does take some work, but really I also believe that that is how you will see actual lasting change versus, just putting like a Band-Aid on something or hiding it under the surface.
Well, you put this in the show notes for this, trust me, have an open mind and trust me. That's focusing on spirit of intent.
I did, yes.
Right? So that's what this is about. If we went into dialogues focusing on spirit of intent, whatever the dialogue is, most people aren't out to get us. Most people don't have their crap together. I don't have all my crap together. Mm-hmm. Most of our listeners, we're all trying to figure it out on this little planet.
Yeah. So I did say that in the show notes. And I do say, I have yours, mine, and the listener's best interests at heart. And I'm not here to try and make anyone look bad or all that jazz. But I am here. Speaking of the show notes, I am here to push thinking a little bit. And one of the things that we're in our last couple of questions or so. But one thing I wanted to do that's on every episode is a thought experiment where we kind of dive into hypothetical situations around the topics and it allows for exploration that are not in the constraints of reality. So we just try to stretch the imagination a little.
Okay, go.
So for you, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you four scenarios that involve a real or fantastical upcoming change. And all you have to do is, if we're trying to make people ready for this change, I want you to think of the first thing that comes to mind for how people could prepare for that change.
Okay. So like a tip or technique, a tool or something. Okay.
Yeah, something like this. Okay.
And you're going to do one at a time, right? Because I'm not good if you do all four.
Absolutely. Okay. One at a time. And for everyone listening, I did not give Greg these ahead of time. I do not know. So, he might have a much better answer tomorrow.
I'm going to focus on the spirit of intent, like I said, to practice.
Okay. So the first change is just a practical one.
Okay, go.
Let's say someone has been living in their area for 20 years and they've watched the demographics change over time. Mm. Suddenly, they see that their very direct neighbors right next to them have put their houses up for sale. What is the first thing they should do to prepare for this future?
Well, I can speak to that from lived experience. I would say the first thing they should probably do is talk themselves off a ledge that someone's going to buy the house and they'll build the bridge and have a relationship with that person and not to get worried too much because worries are made up negative stories.
There you go. People decide it's going to be your best friend and act accordingly.
Absolutely.
Change number two is fantastical. As of exactly 1 month from now, everyone will have the ability to physically teleport their bodies to public places. What is the first thing people should do to prepare for this reality where we can teleport to public places?
Take a shower in the morning.
Why?
Because we want to be clean and not smell where we transport somewhere, depending where you go.
Okay, so wherever you end up, be pleasing to the
You just want to be at your best. Okay. Because remember, when you're at your best, you can respond better.
Okay, so even when you teleport, make sure it's your best self teleporting.
Yeah, make sure when you're teleporting, and just make sure you don't leave half your body behind.
No, yeah, okay. You know what? Figure out a way to bring clothes with you.
I remember watching those Star Trek episodes that science fiction show years ago. And sometimes you, part of you would end up here and some here, and sometimes your clothes would change and be on backwards if there was a malfunction in the transporter system.
That's a good one. Test it in a less public place to see if your clothes come with you.
Good point. You don't want to show up at the United Nations sans vêtements.
Oh my gosh, yeah. But even considering it's thought experiments and not bound by constraints, that would make me think, oh, public places would probably immediately set up change zones. And you only teleport to the change zones.
So what you have to do is go to teleport to Paris, where they have those outdoor washrooms that you plug a euro in and they spin and you can go in. They're all clean.
I just had so much fun ideas for a futuristic movie where you just like teleport to the change zone and like you see a screen, you pick your outfit and then you
exit. I love that.
Okay. Change number three is a practical one again.
Okay.
A company is instituting a 4-day work week in 6 months. What is one thing the company can do to prepare for this change?
Oh, God, I could give you a whole list of things because that's a very common conversation I have right now. What would be the best one to prepare for the change? Can I ask a question? Is there context around this I can ask? Are they already hybrid? Are they remote? Or what's going on with their team? You know what I would say is?
I think maybe you just gave the first step.
Yeah, I would say ask, determine what's going on with the group now and find out how easy or difficult and what all the issues are going to be around that. And even though you might not be able to problem solve all of them, be willing to listen to them. Because listening moves people down that path of change as much as problem solving.
And, everyone listening, ask that question that Greg just asked. The first question should be also, will this affect people differently if they are hybrid, remote, or fully in office?
That's a very technical question, and I agree.
Okay, well, we're going to end on a fun change. Okay. Fantastical one again. A new habitable planet similar to Earth is discovered and is easier to get to than we thought.
Yes.
As of next year, all humanity is invited to travel to and colonize the planet. What should humanity do first to be ready for this change? That's a big one.
This is what I believe. Mm-hmm. So what humanity needs to do is put some structures around in place. By structures, I mean processes, so that we have some guidelines and guidance on how that's going to work.
Okay.
Because I'll tell you, I think when you have good structure and supports, it allows people to do things that are maybe a little more fantastical or different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so set the supports in place for, maybe the optimal version of humanity to be colonizing this.
Yeah, planet. Like I think it's stuff like, it's stuff like, it's like when you do speaking, you're only as good on stage as your AV equipment is. If you've got the structures and supports behind you that everything's working well, you can be yourself. And I think it's the same for going to a new planet. People are just going to want to have some of their worries managed. Mm-hmm. And how we're going to get there. And then people will do it.
Cool. Okay, Greg, we are to the last little section here. Which is called, thank you for playing my game of change.
It's all about how do we build that courage, right? To dive into those waves of change. Because it's fantastical situations are great practice sessions. So I think it's great you're doing that.
I think so too. And I just think that it's fun.
I love fun.
So the last segment on every episode is called Train of Thought. And at the end of each episode, I'll ask the guest to start by summarizing the key theme from what we've talked about. So I'll start by asking you that. What do you think was the key theme of our discussion today?
Oh, I have no idea. I'm more interested. Oh, I just went out of focus.
That's all right. I have thoughts about everything. So.
So I'm interested in what you have to say. I don't know. Maybe the theme is be yourself. And the more you're yourself, the more successful you'll be. If you look at sort of the thread we're talking about from.
Okay. So.
And what were you going to say?
No, I mean, let's go with that because this next one, you really picked a good one there. I would say you know, to be future ready, you know, to something about being future ready is about, you know, building up the skills to thrive and change. But
yeah, being like, and if you want to look at it from a, I was thinking of sort of from personal, but if we look at it more from a future ready perspective, I think future readiness is all about looking at the past and seeing what we're good at and what we've built, and then practicing that a little bit. And then also planning for the future and going, where do I want to go? What do I want to be? What do I want to create? What do I want to look at? Mm-hmm. And how am I going to engage people to make this all happen? Because I can't do it on my own.
Right. Learning from the past, planning for the future, and doing it with others.
Yeah. And being open that others aren't going to think exactly like you. So where are we going to, where's that field that Rumi refers to that we can play in and create that future? Because that's where the magic happens.
Okay. Now the second part of train of thought is that I'm going to give you the theme from the last episode.
Okay.
And your job is to connect it in whatever way comes to mind for you. And this train has been going since the very first episode. So on the last episode, the theme was summed up as, which again, couldn't have chose this one better, seems to work every week, that we ought to try to just be human sometimes, and that is okay.
That sounds like, you know what, it sounds very much like what we've been talking about.
But unplanned.
Yeah, you know, and so what do you want me to do? Try to connect that?
Have to connect being human.
I'm going
to
connect this. It's easy.
Yeah, I know.
So whether we're talking about crooks in jail, nuns, corporate, students, speakers, consultants, educators, the more we shed all that stuff that's people that says we have to be certain ways and blah, 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 that when we bring our true selves forward, that's where we shine. That's where the magic happens. That's where that's where you excel in who you are, in your work, in your school, and in your life. And that sounded a little trite, but it's true.
I mean, being human, and that's okay.
Yeah. And that means we are going to make faults and mistakes and, you know, things and that. I don't know what that was. Was that my cat? You know what the weirdest thing is? When I said that, my light just shook.
Oh, really?
And I haven't touched. Is my cat down here? My cat's not down here.
Well, let's That's pretend the weirdest this is a thing. Sign from the universe that is saying you are on to a major.
Why did that shake? I didn't touch anything. And I went, brrr, I thought my cat was jumping on it. So I think there's a sign from the universe that we've hit on the moment of life.
Cracked the code. Well, we are actually at the end here now. So, Greg, are there any final thoughts you want to give listeners?
Any final thoughts? Don't be too hard on yourself. Change is going to happen. Don't remember worries are made up negative stories. Ground them in fact. And what I really believe is in North America, Western Europe, if we can get through COVID, there's not much we can't do.
Thank you.
More change ready than we think we are.
Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.